ready to proceed?
Good morning, Justice Berger, Chief Justice Steele, and Justice Jacobs. May it please the court, my name is David Weidman, and I represent David and Darlene Dietrich on the appeal before the court. I would respectfully request permission to reserve 2 minutes for any rebuttal. As an initial matter, I believe that I must address the jurisdictional issue that was raised by the Appellee's counsel in footnote 10 of the Appellee's answering brief regarding whether the appeal is properly before this court. I have read the law, and I have reviewed the chronology of the case, and I stand before the court humbly to state that if I have erred by failing to file the appeal properly and I presented the appeal prematurely to this court, then I sincerely apologize to the court and to Appellee's counsel, and I take full responsibility for that error.
Well, the court appreciates your humility, but This is a matter of jurisdiction, so I don't understand how we can kind of overlook it.
I completely agree with you. As I'm stating, when I first addressed the issue when it was brought to my attention in the footnote, and I had not even considered it before then. First, you get the sick feeling in your stomach, and then I researched the law, and I think I have a duty to bring any adverse authority to your attention. I don't think that there is a case that is directly on point on this issue. I can only make a few points to address this issue with the court. In the Pestex case, for example, that was cited by the appellee, the attorney's fees had not been decided by the Court of Chancery in that case. So that in that case, on remand, I believe, or when the court dismissed that appeal, there was still an opportunity for the appellant to file the appeal. In this case, the Court of Chancery decided the issue of the attorney's fees shortly after the motion was filed. And the only points that I can offer to the court, perhaps, are that maybe that cured the defect in the appeal, and perhaps more importantly, the only solace that I can take comfort in is that at the time the Court of Chancery issued its decision on the attorney's fees, this appeal was already pending. So I was in a situation where at that point in time I hadn't even considered the jurisdictional issue, but looking back on it, I don't see how I could have filed a second appeal because this one was already before the court.
Well, perhaps the Court of Chancery didn't have the authority to enter the decision on attorney's fees because the case had already been appealed. I mean, that's just another wrinkle in this problem, but in any case, it is what it is. So.
It is what it is. I had not considered that point, Justice Berger. I don't want to argue against my own case. If I look at the law that was cited by the Appellee's counsel and I look at the other cases that are related to this, even though they're not directly on point, it does appear that by filing the motion for attorney's fees, there was an interlocutory appeal route that I should have taken. Again, at the time that the decision was rendered by the Court of Chancery, however, I couldn't have filed a second appeal. And I suppose looking back in hindsight, retroactively, I could have or should have filed, if it had been brought to my attention, a notice of withdrawal of the appeal or filed my own motion to dismiss my appeal, and then perhaps somehow tried to file a second appeal after the Court of Chancery issued its decision on attorney's fees. I didn't do that. It didn't even cross my mind because, again, I didn't even address this issue until the appellee filed its answering brief. One of the main cases regarding this issue is Julian versus State, and in that case, the court dismissed an appeal even after briefing an oral argument, because when I was researching this, I thought, well, maybe there is a way to save this. And I'm bringing that case to your attention because I think I have a duty to do that. The only thing I can say about that case is that in that matter, the appeal was truly interlocutory because the court had issued a letter opinion on pretrial matters prior to trial. So that case makes more sense to me that even though the briefing had been done and the oral argument had been had, I mean, it involved a pretrial matter.
Well, counsel, just to try to cut through this, at the time that you filed the notice of appeal, as you said, there was no attorney's fee matter pending. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct. I can give you the chronology of what happened here, Justice Jacobs, if you'll permit. The Court of Chancery rendered its decision on April 3rd of 2007, and I filed a motion for attorney's fees about 10 days later on April 13th. After I filed that motion, 4 days later, I filed my notice of appeal to this court. And then the Court of Chancery, rather quickly, I believe, issued its decision on the attorney's fees issue on May 8th, which...
But what you were appealing from was the order relating to the merits, correct?
Yes.
That is implementing the opinion relating to the merits.
That is true.
You did that, perhaps I shouldn't assume, but I'll ask, out of a belief that the order was final?
Yes.
And I suppose if there hadn't have been an attorney's fee motion, it would have been final?
Yes, Your Honor.
So one possibility is that if you were to waive the attorney's fee claim here, that what we might have is, in fact, at least de facto, a final order.
I initially took that position in my reply brief. I agree with that position. And I note that in the Appellee's answering brief, it appears that that's the argument they were making, which is my appeal fails only with respect to the attorney's fees issue. However, again, after I got their answering brief, I thoroughly researched the case law, and I questioned why the appellee limited it to the attorney's fees issue, given the case law. And even though there aren't cases directly on point, my fear was that if I had committed an error in filing a premature appeal, that it affected the entire merits of the case, rather than just the attorney's fees issue. That was an additional point that I was going to raise to the court, and I'm willing to concede that point.
Which point?
The point that the appeal of the attorney's fees issue perhaps is not properly before the court because there was a decision to be made by the Court of Chancery at the time I filed my notice of appeal here.
Well, at the time you filed your notice of appeal, you were asking the Court of Chancery to do something else, correct? That
yes.
is to decide the attorney's fee question. Therefore, one would think it would have occurred to you that the order that you were appealing from wasn't final. Yes, yes?
It did not occur to me, and I can answer.
Well, I'm not trying to get a long apology. I'm just trying to lead you through some analytical steps here to see whether we can hear this case or not.
It did not occur to me, and I'll tell you why it didn't occur to me.
I'm not sure it matters why.
Okay.
But if the attorney's fee issue remains in the case, then we have, it would appear, an interlocutory order
from
which you appealed without complying with the rule.
I agree with you.
If, on the other hand, you were to waive your appeal from that adverse ruling, leaving it final, then perhaps it would be a final order, at least de facto, because there would be nothing left for anybody to do on that issue.
And I've considered that, and I'm fully willing to do that. I don't know how to go about doing that at this point. I didn't.
Well, one way is to say, right now, on the record, I waive the claim for attorney's fees that purportedly on appeal.
I waive the claim for attorney's fees
that
on this appeal.
That works for me. I don't know about my colleagues, but that works for me.
I do waive the claim for attorney's fees because of the reasons we just discussed, and I think that would comport with the
application. Why don't we then go to the merits of the remaining issue?
And I'm prepared to do that, Chief Justice. This case comes before the court because of human error, and that's the irony of me standing in front of you right now. There was a real estate contract that was drafted by an attorney and it failed to contain any provision for interest. I believe that the first issue that I'm presenting to you is a result of error by the trial court, where the trial court imputed an unnegotiated interest rate into this contract using a statute that had not been used in this manner before. This agreement was drafted.
Can I stop you there? Your clients are the ones seeking specific performance, correct?
Correct.
And yet, if I understand your position, you're saying we want specific performance of a contract that's missing a term, correct?
We don't believe the term is missing.
So you're saying as a factual matter, you're objecting to the trial court's factual finding that the parties intended there to be some interest rate?
Yes and no. And the reason I say yes and no is because the court agreed with my clients that there was not an interest rate proffered by the appellee. The appellee said that the contract...
That wasn't my question.
I'm sorry.
If I understand what we have here, we have a contract that does not say in it what the interest rate is, although there is some reference in some other clause to accrued interest, but forgetting that for a moment, there is nothing that says your clients are buying this property for X amount and paying interest at X rate, right? Nothing
right.
about an interest rate.
Right.
Okay. But you want specific performance of this contract. And the other side says it was understood or agreed that there would be an interest rate and that it would be 11-point-something percent. Your client took the position that there was not to be any interest, correct?
Correct.
The trial court made a factual finding that the parties intended there to be some interest rate. Is that not correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So you're asking us to reverse that finding of fact?
Yes.
Okay. And how do we do that? What's the basis for reversing that factual finding?
Because it's not the product of an orderly and deductive process where the contract contains no interest rate.
So even though the court heard evidence about what the parties expected and about your client's past dealings where he always paid interest and his understanding of the time value of money and all that kind of thing, including credibility determinations that the trial court made, we're supposed to forget about all of that and simply look at this contract and say, since it doesn't say an interest rate, that's it.
I don't think you're supposed to forget about it. I think that the analytical framework is whether or not it was fair to draw those inferences that the court attempted to draw from those other pieces of information, meaning that just because he had been involved in other real estate contracts doesn't fall in favor or against either party.
Well, let's take one step back. As I understand the Vice Chancellor's analysis, he concluded that this contract was, to be fair, as ambiguous as any contract he'd ever seen in his career. And as a result, he had to consider extrinsic evidence to determine what the parties believed at the time they had agreed to do, what their relative responsibilities were under the contract. As he explored the facts that supported that extrinsic evidence, he reached the conclusions that Justice Berger's just described. Now, in order for us to reverse his conclusions, we have to conclude that was an abuse of discretion. How do we get there?
You get there, and that's why this case is before the court and why I appealed it, because his decision muddied the waters even further, because by doing what he did, you don't address the fact that there is a clear and unambiguous purchase price of $77,000, and he never addressed the fact that the math, as outlined in the contract, is very straightforward. $800 subtracted from $77,000 gives you the first or the second installment payment.
But he did address it, didn't he?
I don't believe he did.
He was he in his opinion set forth the I guess the characteristics of the agreement or the terms of the agreement that favored your position and the terms of the agreement that favored the other side, and the perhaps the strongest term that the court recognized favored your position is that there was an 11,000, I'm sorry, what was it, a 77,000 $77,000 purchase price. Unfortunately, the agreement also had, in several paragraphs, references to principal and interest. So unless those, the term interest was to be viewed as surplusage and read out of the contract, that created a problem. That is, there was a term that was at odds with the clear, what appeared to be the clear purchase price of $77,000 or $77,000 less $800, correct?
Correct.
Given what the vice chancellor did, essentially construe the term purchase price to mean $77,000 principal amount.
That is what he did, and he went a step further. He imputed an interest rate into the contract that he also said the parties never agreed to. There was no meeting of the minds.
What he meant by that was that precise interest rate they never agreed to.
Correct.
But didn't he also look at the course of conduct of the parties and examine the fact that at one point the sellers said, well, why don't you just pay the existing mortgage company directly and take the interest deduction that you might be allowed as if you were paying the mortgage payment itself? And didn't your clients, in fact, do that?
Yes.
Take an interest on the mortgage deduction on their income tax. Isn't that a fair, excuse me, let me restate that. Wasn't it fair for the vice chancellor then to conclude that the parties did contemplate there would be interest paid? It's just that they entered into a contract that didn't define the amount of interest.
I don't think it was fair for him to conclude that. He did conclude that, but I don't think it was fair because that issue was raised, and he dismissed that issue as well. It was raised by Mr. Chalfant's counsel on an unclean hands doctrine argument, and the court dismissed that.
Can I get at this slightly differently? Since your clients are the ones seeking specific performance, and you've got a contract that the court found did not contain all of the terms of the party's agreement, to the extent that you disagree with that finding, aren't you left with you don't get specific performance? And the contract did not represent a meeting of the minds, and you undo it.
I don't think so, and I think that's why the court brought up the Real Flow case. The court said that just because there is a missing term doesn't mean my clients don't get specific performance.
Well, it seems as if you want it both ways. You've got a contract that arguably does not include all of the terms of the party's agreement, and you still want specific performance of it, but you then complain that the court had no business inserting a term into it. I don't understand how you can be taking both positions.
I don't see it as taking two different positions. Steadfastly throughout the trial and throughout this appeal, our position has been we never negotiated for an interest rate. There is no interest rate in the contract, and I stand before you here today to say that my clients never agreed to an interest rate.
Well, how then could your client reconcile that state of mind, if that was his state of mind, with taking a mortgage deduction?
Rather easily, because at first blush, that does pose a problem. What they did was they went and got their own separate counsel to make sure that what they were doing was proper and not illegal.
In other words, we never contracted to pay any interest.
Yes.
But since the seller is suggesting that we do it anyway, and my independent lawyer says it's okay, we'll do it.
Yes.
Is that
yes.
Your contention as to what happened?
That is exactly what happened.
Is it in the record?
It is in the record. It is in the record. And I'm dealing with a
that
client.
That is, did your client say, you know, there wasn't any interest bargained for, I knew I never was paying any interest, and yet I was taking an interest deduction?
I'm sorry. That is if I understand your question correctly, that is exactly what he said. I have an over-the-road truck driver who bargained for no interest, had the seller come to him and say, you're paying my loan, it includes an interest component, here, you should be taking the interest deduction. Next step is, I don't know if I can do it, get my own tax counsel to run it by my attorney, the attorney says yes.
Okay, let me go at it another way. You've got a contract. You want specific performance. It doesn't say anything about interest. If the court agreed that this was a contract that had no term for interest, wouldn't that make it a contract that is unconscionable and shouldn't be the subject of specific performance?
With your permission, I've run out of time. May I answer that question briefly? I don't think for a second it would make it unconscionable, because the Dietrichs bargained for what they got on the contract, a $77,000 purchase price from their perspective that didn't contain any interest, and they paid under the methodology outlined in the contract, and they followed it to a T.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, you used your rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is James Geddes. I'm here on behalf of the appellee, James Chalfant. Sitting at council table with me is Brooke Leach, my associate.
Welcome.
As I think the court has pointed out through its questioning, the issue here is, what is this contract? And I would suggest to you that it's a series of contracts, some of which are oral, some of which are in writing, or one of which is in writing. And it's clear in the decision law that we cited to you that certainly extrinsic evidence can be introduced. It can be introduced in two different ways. One, if the court finds that the underlying contract is ambiguous, or if there's no integration in a written document of the various understandings of the parties. This court has previously held that if there is no integration, then oral understandings can be introduced to decide what the actual intent of the parties were. Here, you have a series of agreements, one of which is in writing. The first agreement was an oral agreement between the two parties preceding the written document that said, look, you can come live in the house, it's $80,000, and when you can get your financing straight because you have problems with your credit, you're going to refi the house and take me out of this. That was the oral understanding. Mr. Dietrich was the one who suggested that we get this in writing, and Mr. Chalfant went about getting it in writing, a contract which they also looked at as well and was signed. But it's clear it did not have all the elements of the agreement. And in fact, after the agreement, there was a course of conduct that modified it as well. The original payment was $800. They decided to change that to $825.93 to include the insurance. They also decided to change where the payment statements were coming. Instead of to Mr. Chalfant, they changed the address. And in fact, the bank changed the address to send them directly to the appellant. And so there were lots of changes with regard to this agreement. If you also look at some of the other language that hasn't been discussed, you'll see that at closing, the buyer was supposed to pay all the costs. Now, that's consistent with their understanding that this was an $80,000 property. As the lower court stated, originally it was on the market for $99,900, and he dropped it because of lack of interest. And then the appellants came along, and they agreed $80,000. Well, if you don't allow him to, in essence, get the interest on the $80,000 for his loan, he, in essence, is selling it to these people for less than $80,000. Clearly, that was not the arrangement. They had an arrangement that was very simple. These people could not get a loan. They couldn't get it at 11. They couldn't get it at 6. They couldn't get any loan. So the seller financed the transaction through an installment sales contract. And it's quite clear that the law of this state is, if you have a contract, there's interest. The question for the lower court was, what interest? Now, one could disagree with the lower court's analysis as to whether the 1175 should apply. I would say that the lower court's decision on page 13 and the footnote 17 about land sale contracts, one could take a different position with, because the lower court specifically said, well, it's punitive, because there's this liquidation clause that says if you default, I get the property back. Well, that's the only way you can do it. The bank, in essence, has the lien. You can't clear title. You may be the legal owner, but there's no way you can give clear title to a buyer. So the only way you can do it is hold on to the property until the loan's paid. That's exactly what they were doing here. They were waiting until he could get a loan. It makes no sense that they think this was a 0% loan, that they then were going to refinance with 6% paper. That makes no sense at all. Clearly, this was a stopgap situation where they couldn't get financing. The seller wanted to get rid of this property, and so he said, fine, just take out my position, and when you can get financing, take it out. And you can see the rest of the language of the contract is consistent with that, because the buyer is going to pay all the costs. And the amount that they are talking about is exactly the amount that's owed on the loan, within dollars. And so when the court says, I would think that in that situation you would have a lower interest rate, one could disagree with that, because in essence, the seller is financing this, and he's basically saying, I'm not making any money on this. I'm just letting you step in my shoes. So I don't know why the court was concerned that somehow the liquidation language that says he keeps the property if they default would induce somebody to think the loan rate should be lower. So with respect to that, that's one issue. But the lower court decided that there was no agreement with regard to the interest rate. And so the court did what's consistent with the law in this state, which is if there's no interest rate, we're going to apply the legal interest rate, which is under 62301. That's exactly what they did. And I don't see how anyone can argue that there wasn't implied in this contract an interest rate. It's clearly consistent with the decisional law. It's consistent with the decision in this court in Watkins, which says a contract has interest. If it's not a cash deal, it has interest. And, you know, the court below said there's no free lunch. Well, certainly they couldn't expect that this was an interest-free deal, because if it was an interest-free deal, then he was in essence selling a house for less than $80,000 if he was paying 11.75% to the bank. And they agreed that it was a fair price at $80,000. So the only reasonable interpretation is that the seller was getting some compensation for the interest, i.e., the buyer was paying the interest and, in fact, was deducting the interest, the full amount of interest that he saw every month on his statements that came to him, and then he went to his accountant and said, can I deduct this? And the accountant said, you can, because you are paying the mortgage. It cannot be any clearer than that. And so why they now try to convolute this into some, quote, understanding that there was no interest on this transaction, when the gentleman had three houses in Pennsylvania, had mortgages, and nowhere in the record does he ever say that the seller agreed to finance this property for him with no interest. It makes no sense. So the only issue for this court really is whether the legal rate of interest is the appropriate rate or some other rate. Now, parole evidence, I think, comes in either through the ambiguous clause issue or the fact that there's no integration. But clearly in 2.3 and 2.4 of the installment sales contract, it talks about interest, accrued or and interest. This is a 2.3 situation. They are prepaying this loan. That was the deal. The deal was once he could get his financing organized, he would come and take him out. And so we are in a prepayment situation where the language of the contract is very clear, principal and accrued interest. To read that out of the contract would be consistent or inconsistent with Justice Jacobs' decision in DCV Holdings versus ConAgra, which clearly says you cannot interpret a contract in such a way as that you make nullity of some of the language. That's what you would be doing here. So the only issue before this court, since the attorney's fees has been resolved, is whether the interest rate is 7.25 or 11.7.
So you agree, contrary to the position you took in footnote 10 on page 22, that this appeal is now properly before the court?
Based on the representations today made by counsel, yes. And that's really all I have to say, unless the court has more questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.